Well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. That singing was very inspiring. I had my entire education was fairly Anglican, so it brought back some very fond memories. Anyway, my name is Amy Hogan, as you can probably tell. Or hopefully. Maybe just work out how to... And I'm going to talk to you today about three things. I'm going to talk about my life and some of my philosophies around disability and living with a chronic disability. Mine has specific reference to cerebral palsy, but I think it has some general themes that can be well traced beyond just simply my condition. I'm going to talk about the research that I've undertook with the Cerebral Palsy Society, and I'm going to give you a little bit of information about the Cerebral Palsy Society itself. And if we get time, I'm going to talk about Bonnie, because she's pretty much just that adorable that she needs to be talked about, really. Well, this is me. I'm 24, and I was born in 1986. At 24 weeks premature, which was, for that decade, was pretty remarkable. I have spastic cerebral palsy, which, as some of you know, I can see some people I know in the audience, is a condition of muscular tiredness and weakness. I've been living with it and living with its side effects all my life, as well as been through a lot of the procedures in order to correct some of the damage. Some of them were successful, some of them weren't. But through all that, I've learned several things about what it's like to live with a disability and how to do it, if not successfully, because there's no way to really quantify success. But I've learned some things that I found useful, and I thought maybe I could pass them on today. I have my wonderful mobility dog, Bonnie, who helps me do a lot of things. Principally, she picks stuff off of the floor for me and gives them to me. She takes off my shoes and socks and gives them to me. She goes and gets my mum and dad when I need help, which is really good if I fall in the bathroom or anything like that. And I'm sure anybody who's in the chair or anybody who works with a person in the chair can fully relate to that. The awkwardness of when you fall and you can't directly get help. She braces for me, so when I transfer, I get a help. Bonnie, quit eating your foot. You're not doing a very good job of looking like a decent mobility dog. She's a lab cross poodle, so she's very alert and very affectionate, as some of you know, having her rather enthusiastic greeting. I am an enthusiastic amateur historian. I did my degree in history and psychology, my two major interests, looking at mental health and history, and I know they probably don't seem like they marry together well, but I find they do. And I love to garden, and I also love to write. I do write a lot of poetry and short stories. So that's me in a nutshell. It takes a while to come up. I also work for a prison rehab program. That's just me in picture form. And that's Bonnie Gill at my graduation. And that's my niece who turns 1 year old today. And after this, I'm going directly to her party, so I'm looking forward to that a lot. Now, here, this is my basic philosophy about disability. And it's always a bit dangerous to say such things like that, because people get quite worked up about the notion that one person would have a philosophy about disability, when disability is so broad and vast in terms of the differences. But again, this is just my opinion, and if you take something away from it, that's great. If you don't, forget it in 20 minutes or so. It's all up to you. It's entirely voluntary. Now, the first thing I wanted to talk about is that age-old adage, there's no such thing as normal, which is true to an extent, but let's face it, there is neurotypical development, and a lot of us aren't going to meet that. We're not going to be the typical person walking down the who can do it without raising any attention or getting the stares or getting the "what's wrong with you" questions or and all that. But what the way I wanted to frame the whole normal debate is you should always strive to interact with the community and to enter so-called normal activities. And there's nothing worse than, and we all know what it's like, you turn up to an able-bodied event and there's no sort of adaptation for you and you end up getting carried up the stairs and people start panicking when they see you in the chair because it's too big than they thought it was going to be and they don't know what to do with you, so they end up putting you out the side of the field refereeing the cross-country or whatever. And that tends to get pretty demoralizing. But what I was going to say is that there's no such thing as normal. Of course there isn't, but there's a way to work to more normal and more typical standards. But the way to do it is to be sensible about it. Don't try and push yourself into so-called normal just because you feel like you need to. We can enter normal activities. They just need to be researched. You need to be made aware of them, and the way you can do it in a wheelchair. Like, for example, I've always been fascinated by archery, and the amount of people who I've told this to have given me very strange looks, because someone who doesn't exactly have the greatest muscular control wants to be in charge of a deadly weapon. But I went to the Parafed Auckland, and I told them about it, and they were like, sure, let's come and research this and let's do it in a safe way and see how you can do it and make sure you don't hit anybody. And so that's how I did it. I researched within my limits to see if I could do it. I wanted to do this activity, but I knew I couldn't just rock up to everyday archery. So I researched it. I researched it and I got some feedback around how I could do it safely and effectively, and that's the underlying principle of what I believe about being normal. Is we can engage and we can do whatever we want to, but we just need to know how to do it within our limits. There are things out there that can do all sorts of things, and we've all seen them on the news. We've all seen the people who climb Mount Everest, and we don't all have to do that. I'm not saying that in order to be a decent disabled person you need to climb Mount Everest, because who would want to? I certainly don't want to freeze. But whatever your dream is, whatever you inspire to do, don't be nervous to do it just because you feel like you need to be normal and look normal. You don't. There are ways to do it within your own limits and to be a normal person with a disability. Just like you're a normal person who's hugely tall or hugely short or hugely fat or whatever. And that comes back to my next point of extraordinary. People tend to, if you're in a wheelchair, they tend to assume your IQ goes down by about 30 points. So they don't really have high expectations of you. So really, when I'm in an able-bodied audience, I could probably stand here and recite the alphabet correctly and still get some fairly big applause. And that can sometimes tend to get labelled extraordinary. But the difference is with labelled like extraordinary and the difficulty with it is that it sort of visibilises the fact that it's hard and you have to do a lot of work to meet these very limited goals that people have of you. And it's not particularly extraordinary, it's just what I need to do and what you need to do and what everybody needs to do. And extraordinary can be making it out of bed when you're really, really sore and your joints are really, really playing up. That's extraordinary. It's not extraordinary when you've reached a particular goal with lots of support. And I had lots of support to do what I've done, and Mark Ingalls had a lot of support to do what he's done, and all those kind of examples. Extraordinary is when you don't have the support and you still achieve things. Like, I think Mark Ingalls and John Kirwan. John Kirwan is in particular an example of this because he was very courageous with his mental health issues, and he didn't need to do that, and he did, and he was a real advocate. So I think you can be extraordinary by just being your everyday self. There's often a pressure within the sector to be an amazing advocate and to really fight the system and to stand on these soapboxes and talk about the wider discourse of disability. But I think that that's wrong, because it's not wrong to do if you want to do it, but I don't think people should feel the pressure to do it. I think you can be an effective advocate just by living your own life and breaking down the barriers like that. And my last point is, and I will hardly contest this with anybody, but I think is that it's much better to be in control of the help you get rather than try to be stoically independent and end up exhausting yourself. For example, I could probably get myself dressed entirely independently, but it would probably be 6 p.m. in the evening before I got anywhere. And I don't really want to spend hours contemplating my shoelaces, trying to figure out which way the bunny ears goes and unlearn how to tie an effective knot. It's just not going to happen for me. But instead, I can tell people how to help me, and I'm still in control of that. It's a bit like with Bonnie. I'm in control of how she helps me. So that's just a different form of independence. It's a level of dependence, but it's a more sensible independence than trying to strive to be completely independent and to meet a notion that doesn't really exist. Because, let's face it, when you've got a chronic disability, you can be fine and independent one day and really, really wiped out the next. So you can't really have a stable level from which to base your striving for independence. And now we come to the next section of my speech. And I think I'm still on time, so that's good. And I want to talk about my research, cerebral palsy through the lifespan. And this, while this is specifically related to CP, there are many crossover areas which I think will be of value to other disabilities. Basically, cerebral palsy through the lifespan came out of the notion that there's a whole lot of emphasis on disabilities in pediatrics and working with kids with disabilities, but there isn't a lot of follow-on with the adults. So you get all these really nicely turned out children, and you kind of send them into a bit of a no man's zone of what to do from here. You don't get the maintenance of all this nice, pretty stuff that happens when you're younger. And that's what we started conceptualizing. Maybe there needs to be a study of cerebral palsy or anything through the lifespan so that people can have a level of reference for when they get older, or when their children get older, or when their patients get older, or whatever. And a large part of this came out of... Oh, did I hit the thing again? There we go. A large part of this came out of the notion that cerebral palsy is a massive label. I have less in common with some people on the spectrum than I do with somebody who doesn't have cerebral palsy. And yet we all get lumped together under this great umbrella term known as cerebral palsy. And there isn't really the ability to tease it out into the specific kinds and the specific levels, because they each have very different needs. So what we're hoping to do is to be able to look at the individual differences that comes along with being a level 2 with cerebral palsy or a level 3, and be able to apportion the funds accordingly. And we also wanted to look at some of the major gaps in the current research of cerebral palsy and other conditions for that matter, in the sense of there's a lot of stuff on based largely around the medical model, but there's very little that extends beyond it, which is, to be fair, they're starting to recognise and they're starting to bring in people like psychologists and psychiatrists to look at the more mental and social side of it, but it's still very much in its infancy and it's still very difficult to break any research from the great ivory towers of academia into the actual community and to get within the constructive discourse of actually helping people with disabilities and actually bringing the information to mean something on an everyday level. It's all very well to get shiny PhDs, but we want it to actually work on the grassroots level. So we're hoping to do that, pretty much, have a closed loop of information. And that's just the fact that you don't really know what it's like to grow up with CP. I know what it's like to grow up with CP. Some of the guys here know what it's like to grow up with CP, but there's no collective narrative of, and there's no reference points for growing up with CP. We have no map. We have no way to predict anything. And, of course, individual differences exist. My experience isn't going to be the same as Mandy's or Kim's or anybody else. But it would be good if we could pick out some of the key themes and hopefully give some resources to them so that we don't have to feel like we struggle on our own, because we don't. There's a huge amount of resources out there, but there's no way to centralise it at this stage. And through this year, I've formulated and developed a questionnaire based around the key topics that I and people with cerebral palsy have found during focus groups. And these are largely looking at the mental health, looking at key relationships, both family and intimate relationships, looking at services provided, looking at practical barriers, education, and legal and medical structures. And just to base, and these aren't exact topics in the sense that we don't think this is going to cover everything within cerebral palsy, but this is going to be a starting point for any references. And we're hoping to eventually expand some of the topics out to be individual surveys if it's shown that it brings particularly interesting information. Like, for example, if we learn that there's a particular people with cerebral palsy are particularly more vulnerable to secondary conditions like arthritis and osteoporosis, which makes a level of intuitive sense, but again, we don't know. So we're going to have a mixed design of face-to-face interviews and online surveys. At the moment, it's based in Auckland, but we are definitely looking at expanding out to other centres in New Zealand. And again, we are hoping to produce a central location of information where we can just be a central repository for people to ask questions about CP. And it may not be that you get the question answered exactly, but we're hoping that there'll be some sort of reference point for you to springboard and get more information, even if it's just a contact to somebody who's been through a similar experience. For example, how many people with CP over 50 have a particular condition, or how many people over uni completed a university degree, or how many people with CP are in employment, so we can get a specific profile of what it's like to have CP, and also what it's like to have CP within the specific profiles of having athetoid CP or spastic cerebral palsy, or a mixture of both. So that people can tailor their information beyond simply this vague notion of having brain damage, which is essentially what CP is. Finally, I just thought I'd give you a brief overview of the Cerebral Palsy Society. Some of you know as members, but I just thought I'd tack it on to the end. The Cerebral Palsy Society is coming up for its 60th anniversary next year, so it's a fairly well-established society. Working with the it's a charitable incorporated society whose mission it is to provide enhance for the well-being of people with CP by giving them their own choices, which essentially means that we want to know what people want so we can facilitate it easily for them. And we've got a number of programs up and running. The Get Out There program, which subsidizes taxis beyond the total mobility scheme. The Get Connected program, which helps people set up computers or laptops so that they'll have access to the internet. The Get Structured program, which works on helping people establish their wills and trusts by subsidizing lawyers' fees, which I know it sounds like a daunting prospect, but it is actually extremely useful, particularly when you start looking at things like what's going to happen when people's primary carers pass on. And we have the Get This and That, which is to look at helping people fund off one-off things that they can't get direct funding for, like knives and forks and cutlery and things like that. And we have the General Grants Committee, which means that you can apply for money and it'll go to the Grants Committee and it'll be sent out as a one-off grant. We have academic scholarships, and we also have a CP neighbourhood, which looks at producing the links and establishing the links in the local neighbourhood of people with CP so that we can share the local resources and occasionally swap carers if need be and all that kind of stuff by having local support that doesn't rely on a central organisation. We have a monthly magazine called The Review, which basically just overviews everything that's going on, not only with the society, but in national trends. We're following through a lot of the debate and controversy around stem cells at the moment. We have a membership currently of roughly, this has probably changed since I last looked, but it's close to 724. And that's nationwide. Most of it is centred in Auckland. That's simply because the society is here and a lot of the disability support stuff is based in Auckland. But we're gradually, and we're hoping to do this, is establish a greater presence out in the other towns, particularly so that we can start reaching the people who don't have the direct access to the more big town, the bigger towns like Christchurch and Wellington. So that's one of our major aspirations. We have a number of different staff members who do different jobs, different roles within the society, and belong to particular programs. And now I know that you guys are going to have a lot to talk about today and probably won't remember everything I've said, although apparently it's going to be recorded, so if you feel so inspired, I suppose you could go back and listen to the highlights. But if you could just remember two things from this talk, that there are some really great grassroots research going on, not only with CP, but also with other disabilities, and I've been in touch with the Neuromuscular Alliance, and that we're all looking at really trying to produce this more global and comprehensive picture of disability that doesn't just revolve around the medical model and really obscure things like the 777th study on scoliosis or ankles, actually getting down to practical information. Or at least that's the hope. And one other thing, if I could leave you with, is that things are possible. And it may seem like I'm in a chair, I can't do this, or maybe you've even been told that, no, that's way too dangerous, or somebody like you could never do that. Think about your safety. And of course, your safety is important, but there's no harm in dreaming and going for it and striving for it. I mean, if I can do archery and yoga, pretty much anybody can do anything, given no parameters. It's just about getting the information and researching the information and having a degree of persistence with it. Because there are people willing to help out. There are people like your fellowship, and it just needs a dialogue just needs to be open. And I think it can be done. I really do. And I think the saddest thing in the world is not having a disability. It's having a disability and thinking that that will prohibit you from doing something you really want to do. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to join the cast of Cirque du Soleil or Riverdance. I could try, I suppose, but there's things that you can do. I mean, there are things that are going to stop able-bodied people from joining Riverdance or Cirque du Soleil. But if you really want to do it, you can do it. Anything's possible. I really believe that. So if anybody has any questions, feel free to come up to me after, or I can hang out and talk up here if you like. And I've got a lot of cards to give out, so don't be shy. I'm here for another 20 minutes or so sure. We can, because a lot of people with cerebral palsy often have an intellectual component, so we're well established at working on that side too. Well, that essentially comes down to what I was saying about cerebral palsy being a giant label, because all cerebral palsy basically is a stroke that affects the brain under 1 year of age. So it can affect any aspect of the brain. I had a series of 4 brain bleeds when I was younger, and in the various parts of my brain that control movement and things. So other people will have damage that involves their learning and their cognitive side. So it just depends on where the injury happens. Because cerebral palsy can mean anything, it really can. Like, I have some very subtle learning deficits and the fact that I have mild dyslexia and things like that, but that's just a result of where the brain bleed was and the fact that I was born so, so early. But where was I born? As in what kind of hospital, or what was my location? Like, where... I was born in Titirangi. Yay! Go to the ring! But I moved to Auckland very quickly after we realised how sick I was going to be and how many resources I'd need. Yes, I can. It's quite common to have cerebral palsy when you're born really early.
How premature, how many weeks premature, was the baby that has survived into adulthood? Would you have any idea?
What do you mean? You mean like the...
You were 24 weeks, yes. And you said that it would be earlier ones now.
The youngest that I know of was 23 weeks, who was born, I think, about 7 months ago. She was still very, very... They were really pushing the envelope with her, because 24 weeks is the cutoff for lung development. Your lungs are only fully formed at 24 weeks, so any earlier really pushed to get those up and running, so to speak.
Some people with cerebral palsy, I'm very mild, praise God, were born with lack of oxygen,
yes,
to the brain. Is that cause with yours?
No, it wasn't specifically, but I was pretty much too young to survive on my own, so I was given a lot of intervention and a lot of, like, pure oxygen and things. Mm. But I didn't have a traumatic birth. I was just born far, far too early, and that left my brain open to bleeding. Because I was so young that I had no... My skin wasn't formed, so Mum and Dad could see all my organs underneath all my skin, because I was a couple of weeks too early to have proper skin.
Size of a block of butter I was
less than a pound of butter, and my dad's wedding ring could fit up on my collarbone. Go. Yeah, I was very, very tiny. Well, thank you very much for listening to me, and...